All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
When I say beyond socialism and capitalism conventionally defined, I'm talking about a pretty unique balance between industry and state, state coordination and market mechanisms, individualism and communalism. And so China has decided that it's going to be on one part of that spectrum. Now, America might be totally, you know, on the one end of free markets. China might be somewhere in between, but there's not just one model. And so I don't think it's necessary communism, but, you know, how much state coordination, state role, state intervention is allowed. Personally, I think that China has come to an age where it needs a lot more markets and a lot less state.
That's Caillou Jin, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Caillou Jin on the Chinese economic system. China is a paradoxical global power. It's run by the Communist Party, and at the same time, it has a huge private sector, which includes the world's largest number of billionaires. Its economy has been described as a mix of state capitalism and market socialism. Internationally, its Belt and Road Initiative has spread its economic and political influence. Washington views China as, quote, a grave threat to the economic well-being and democratic values of the United States, unquote. The trade war between the two countries grows. Washington imposes tariffs on Chinese imports. China just sends more goods to Africa and Latin America. The U.S. has surrounded China with a string of military bases. Taiwan and the South China Sea remain highly contentious issues. How U.S.-China relations play out will define geopolitics in the coming years. Our guest today is Caillou Jin. She's a professor of economics at the London School of Economics and Political Science. She's the author of The New China Playbook, Beyond Socialism and Capitalism. She spoke at the Westminster Town Hall Forum in Minneapolis in mid-April. The moderator is Tane Danger. And now, Caillou Jin.
In 1997, I moved to America. I was 14. I was alone. I arrived at the doorsteps of an American family who actually took me in. They thought I was only staying for a week during an exchange program, and I stayed for 3 years. Just months before I arrived, I was a proud member of the Party Youth League in China. I was studying Marxist economic and political thought in school, and it never occurred to me, nor to my friends, that there was something called fun plans on a Friday night. And of course, that all changed when I got here to this country. I was genuinely mesmerized by the openness, by the free thinking, and I was a little shocked to be encouraged by my history teacher to question authority, textbooks, teacher, and even facts. Ooh, what a foreign concept. And I was surprised to learn that in school life, there was something actually more important than grades. And the China I knew from back home, exuberant, dynamic, ever-changing so fast, was so different from the China that Americans had in mind when they asked me questions when I got there, as if it was kind of a dark place of terror. And that contrast in perspective really stuck with me ever since. Now, thinking back, this little story of mine, I think, really embodies a lot of the differences, the misunderstandings, potentially the cultural gaps that we have between the two countries, U.S. and China, and that's why I wanted to share it with you today. Now, I wrote this book, The New China Playbook, and trying to explain how China actually works how it has come to foster a really unique model that goes beyond conventional socialism or capitalism, and also how China has a new generation of Chinese radically different from the older generations, and they're going to change the face of China. So my goal was to hopefully give a perspective from the inside, based on data, facts, and a huge amount of wonderful, serious scholarly works that has been done on the Chinese economy by international scholars over the years. And most of all, rise above the emotions and sensationalism and the news cycle. And so I wanted to tell a different side of the story, and there is always a different side of the story. And given how tense things have become between the two countries, US and China, I think it is important to tell that story. So allow me to offer you a different perspective and lens to look through. So people ask me often, what are the biggest misunderstandings about China? Now, one of it is actually how the model works. Now, 30 million private companies sprung out from nowhere, like mushrooms spring up from a desert, in so little. In the beginning stages and beginning ages of the 1980s, China was a thoroughly anti-capitalistic economy, and suddenly 30 million out of nowhere. And we tend to think of China's system as being extremely centralized, as if everything is decisions made on the top by a few people, maybe even one person. But that's not quite accurate. Politically, it's very centralized, but economically, it's extremely decentralized. Decisions, implementation, are all made on the ground, decided by local officials who actually go about helping private entrepreneurs to succeed. I call this the mayor economy. Local provincial leaders, I mean, they could be mayors, they could be party secretaries, in charge of turning backward fishing villages into global technology hubs, like Shenzhen. And that's what they did. I don't know what we expect our mayors to do for us in this country, but in China, that was their mandate. It was to help growth, it was to implement these radical reforms, it was to help protect the environment, to really encourage the private entrepreneurs to build something new. And so currently, even fast forward many years, today, they're running around all over the country building mini Silicon Valleys, helping private entrepreneurs find talent, coordinate financing, build a whole industrial clutter around key companies like EVs or semiconductors. The Shanghainese government actually gave money and cheap land to Tesla, hoping that they would build factories and sell cars there. Chinese local governments giving, subsidizing American companies in China. People were fine with that. They liked it. They bought Tesla cars. They're all over the streets of China today. And so, a lot of people don't understand what are the incentives behind these mayors, you know, the decentralized economy, that they would want to do this for the private entrepreneurs and help the economy. Well, that comes back to some pretty unique institutional features in China. So to be promoted to the higher rungs of the political hierarchy, and everybody wanted to be promoted, you needed to do a good job for the local economy. And on top of that, by doing that, you got more jobs, filled your fiscal coffers, and the land you own, which the local governments own, are actually worth more. And most of all, you needed the private entrepreneurs to help you, right? We usually think about China as if the state kind of suppresses the private or surprises. No, actually, it's quite the opposite. They need the private entrepreneurs because they're the most productive and they're the most innovative. So there were huge incentives. And on top of that, there was a lot of competition across the regions in China. It was like a beauty contest, you know, contesting for the best and promising entrepreneurs, and you had to be friendly to them. You had to be nice to them. You had to be helpful. So in the data, we see that the cleanest, friendliest local governments saw the fastest growth and the rise of the largest companies. And those that were more corrupt, more extractive, they lost out. So there's an incentive to behave, to actually lend a helping hand rather than a grabbing hand, which some might expect in a country with a poor rule of law or too much political power concentrated in the hands of too few would have been very difficult. But that was what the mayors did. And you didn't need every mayor to be like that. You know, China's a big country. There are tens of thousands of local governments, and many of them were corrupt, and money went into their pockets, but the majority were incentivized. And that was enough to lead to this seismic change at breakneck pace. Now, leaving aside what we think about China and their problems, their challenges, we're seeing the economy slow down at a significant pace today. It is still a fact that it is the country that has been growing the fastest for the longest period of time in all of human history. And that is a fact. So something must have gone right. Now, this comes to a broader point and a more contested point, which is, what do we actually think about the role of the state? I'm a Western-trained economist. I can tell you in our models and our intellectual thinking framework, there's very little room for the state, except for maybe regulations, maybe stepping in when there are market failures. But I can also understand culturally and historically why we feel so uneasy about state interventions. And we've also seen the state overreaching and being too heavy-handed, of course, and these are problems. But sitting around many of these meetings with politicians, leaders, experts, talking about development and developing countries, a perennial thing that comes up is not enough state capacity. Emerging markets need to double their infrastructure in the next few years. Not enough state coordination. Not enough investment. That's a fact as well. And China didn't have that problem. China actually had the opposite problem, too much infrastructure, which was also wasteful. It was inefficient. But it was still a better problem to have than to not have enough connectivity to unleash people's productivity on balance. Now, for all of its expedience, the model has serious challenges. It's being tested. It's much less effective now. Growth is slowing down. Huge amounts of debt. 140 million vacant homes to be filled in who knows how many years. There's too much capacity, too much supply, not enough demand. The financial system is really a living dinosaur. Too little credit for the small and medium-sized enterprises. And that's the other side of this high growth, high cost model. It was costly. There were waste. But to the Chinese, on net, the benefits still outweighed the cost because a billion people were lifted out of poverty. And even today, it's the first time that you have a developing country being able to use technology. And despite the problems, and I'm sure there'll be many questions about Chinese economies today, and I'll share with you my muse, I still think it's too early to write China off. This country, this very country, the US, we've had 12 recessions in the last century. It took more than 10 years to recover from the Great Recession of 2009. China is currently experiencing its first serious economic recession in the last 40 years. The potential is still there. There's a vast majority of people underemployed, undereducated in the rural areas. And even just between China, where China is today, and its potential, whether it's in terms of urbanization, tertiary education, the service sector, productivity, there's a big gap still yet to be filled. And again, even in this country, we've seen over time that poorer states converged to the richer states. It's in the data, and it's also going to happen to China. So there's still room for growth. Now, the second misunderstanding is about Chinese aspirations. Some in this country may think that China's sole goal is to overtake the US. Geez, that's a lot of responsibilities in the world. No, thank you. And no, not feasible. The daily preoccupation of the vast majority of Chinese today is still about putting food on their table and keeping their kids in school, not really having a dangerous obsession about America, really. It doesn't believe that worrying about America is actually going to solve its own problems, and the government needs to keep its own house in order. There's a lot of domestic challenges. And by the way, talking about aspirations, we're going to have to accept that there will be similar aspirations from India, Indonesia, Vietnam, the entire African continent. They are rising. They have huge aspirations to peddle their way to prosperity, and we'll have to need to deal with that too. They're going to start selling cheap goods to China, use its technology. And by the way, some of that is already happening as factories are moving to Southeast Asia en masse. The Chinese don't really have much time to talk about the Vietnamese stealing their jobs. We don't really hear about it in the newspapers. Instead, what they hear about is they should invest more in smart manufacturing, in up-tooling, upskilling their workers, climbing up the value chain so they're not forever stuck and condemned to producing cheap goods. Climbing up the global value chain is what they're focused on. And maybe it's also another cultural thing to do. And again, culture and history is something I like to talk about a little bit, because I do think we kind of sometimes underestimate how important they are, and that contributes to some of the misunderstandings. But it's a cultural thing to do in China to turn a crisis into motivation. Now, speaking of President Biden's export controls on semiconductors, or, you know, kind of asking companies to break off ties with China or to stop selling to them, well, initially it didn't go down that well in China. But then they kind of just turned it into a positive attitude. It totally mobilized everybody. They whipped companies into shape. For the longest time, they were actually comfortably importing American chips, and now all of a sudden they have to start buying Chinese chips. And not because the Chinese government forced them to, but rather it's because of these policies from America. So, and in fact, they said, well, thank you for keeping us on our toes. There were huge accelerations in these domestic industries, and there was almost a national euphoria when they made breakthroughs in the chip industry. Small victories, but still small triumphs, and the Chinese people were pretty happy. They turned this around and said, oh, this is pretty positive. To look at to the rise of African India, does China want to see that as a threat or opportunity? I actually really think they see it as an opportunity, and that rest of the world is coming. 90% of the people in the world still live in the developing countries, and they too have that kind of aspirations. And third, finally, the Chinese people, the misunderstandings, and the new generation. That's actually what I enjoy talking about the most. It's what gives me the most hope that we are going to do much better with a new generation, and that we're not actually headed on a collision course. The new generation, born after the one-child policy in the 1980s, I was among the first generation. I have lots of thoughts about it. I've done lots of research about it. It's a fascinating topic. They are radically different from my parents' age, you know, going through huge vicissitudes, economic, psychological hardships in China during these turbulent times. The new generation, they love leisure, consuming, spending, money on clothes, traveling, entertainment, all of that. They even like to borrow to spend. We used to think about China as a big saver, you know, saving so much and then flooding the world with capital and products. Well, this generation is different. They borrow. They spend. 85% of the consumer credit is actually accounted for by people under 35. One click on Alibaba's, you know, e-commerce website, you can borrow to buy lipstick. That's what college students do. I don't know who pays them back, maybe their parents, but anyway, they still love to borrow. The mentality has totally shifted. And despite what we think about the one-child policy, the dark sides, there were also some unintended consequences. For one, it seriously raised the status of Chinese women. Why? Because you used to educate your sons first before your daughters. And everybody now with a daughter pour all the resources into her, the modern Mulans of every family, right? And we see in the data that the gender gap completely closed in my generation for attainment in higher education. And in the data, among the business leaders, those born in the 1990s, 45% of the business leaders are women, compared to only 6% of those born in the 60s, or 10% for those born in the 1970s. So it really accelerated the closing of the gender gap for China in this formerly very traditional Confucian society, way above what economic growth would have predicted in other countries. And moreover, this is a really open-minded generation. I've looked at lots of international surveys about them. They care about things like diversity, animal rights, social inequity. They feel more confident. You know, the kind of factory workers that opted for three shifts a night back in those days, that's not in their generation. They're more relaxed, more chill, you know. It's not a bad thing. They're not going to be working as hard, as tenacious, but they have a broader, you know, perspective about life in general. And also, they communicate better. Many of them have been educated in this country. A third of international students in this country are Chinese students. And 5 million visitors before the pandemic come to this country. They are fluent with the Western culture, the language, and they would be great ambassadors for China. And they connect much better with the Gen Zs around the world, and they are that bridge. And they're also very innovative. Now, this is again a fact. Despite what's happening between the two countries, I don't know if you noticed, but 4 out of 5 of the most downloaded apps today are actually Chinese. I don't know if it will stay this way, but you know, the new generation, they have much less of a culture divide and gap. And so let me leave with this thought. Our great leader, Deng Xiaoping, who really pushed the country for reforms and opening up and really was the forefather of this miracle success, used to say about intractable problems, and we had many back in those days as well, let's leave it to the smarter, younger generation to figure it out. They're going to sort it out. But at the same time, we still need to hold the world together for them to actually give them that chance. I don't think that on top of all the debt that we're going to throw at them or the dirtier planet, that we really want to add a more dangerous world on the cusp of collapse to the mix. And we can also expect that when the next global financial crisis comes around the corner, and I'm certainly sure it will, the two central banks in US and China, they're going to have to call each other up. That if there's ever a hope of realizing the green transition, we are going to need the cheapest, cleanest energy and technology, and a whole lot of investment and collaboration to make it happen. And everybody here is here to stay. Nobody's really going anywhere. We're here. So let's keep the people-to-people connection, keep the dialogues open, have some goodwill, and maybe even just start from small victories. And I believe over time, even more can be achieved. Thank you. The model is being tested. I really argue that state coordination, state mobilization was really important for a certain stage of development. China has reached the stage of development where there needs to be a lot more markets and a lot less state. And so that has to change. But there are some signs that things are changing over time. But, you know, we also have to wonder, as I alluded to this as well, the ups and downs are part of the features of, you know, economic cycles. And one big difference is that this country had something like a $5 trillion stimulus package over the pandemic. Chinese households had nothing. And there is, you know, a serious loss of confidence and also loss of opportunities. So it's going to take time for the economy to recover. And by the way, China's already massive. It's already big. So to keep on growing that fast is going to be very difficult. India, everybody talks about India, and India is definitely an exciting place. But even if India grows, let's say, 4 to 5 percentage points faster than China until 2030, China's still going to contribute $130 trillion more of GDP to the world than India. So it has to slow down anyways. But look, you know, I think a broader question is, can we have more expertise in the system? Can the people's preferences be reflected more in the leadership's decisions? That all requires a huge amount of reforms. What I'm worried about most is when countries get to a certain income level and they drop the pro-growth agenda. And that would be really, really sad for China and for the rest of the world too.
There's a question here about China potentially trying to a strategy to take the place or at least compete with the U.S. as the world's monetary exchange. This could probably get very technical, but I'm wondering if you can help kind of orient us around what that space is in that conversation.
China has, among its other ambitions or aspirations, wants to internationalize the RMB. You know, dollar is very powerful. Dollar is very, very dominant. So I think it has the plans, but realistically, it is still very, very far from coming close to that goal of being even really an international currency. Why? Very, very simply and very briefly, you need a financial system like the U.S. Breadth, liquidity, size. Just look at the U.S. treasuries. It's not just trade denominated in dollars, but the lending is also denominated in dollars. And it's very, very hard to replace that. But that said, again, we cannot forget the other part of the world, the massive emerging developing world. They have a desire for a parallel movement of maybe a common currency, maybe an alternative to the dollar, albeit being very difficult. That is a desire in the financial system, but it's also very difficult to achieve.
There's a couple of different questions about Hong Kong and about Hong Kong's ability to self-determine, but also at least one about Hong Kong as a global financial center and whether that changes as it is sort of, it's in a different world now where it's become part of mainland China in this way. So I'm wondering if you can talk about both of those, both sort of the relationship that we've seen over the last years with China and Hong Kong, and then also the financial sort of center implications of that.
The fate of Hong Kong and mainland China are inextricably linked. If Hong Kong does well, it makes China look good. And if China's economy does well, it would be good for Hong Kong's economy because Hong Kong is the financial center, the conduit through which a lot of the capital investment flows. And so I recently went to Hong Kong, and they were still pretty optimistic because even though a lot of people left, some new people are coming back, and they're reinventing themselves. I'm not an expert on Hong Kong, but I do just want to mention one thing. And in the spirit of just giving you another side of the story, because we're all familiar with one side of the story, the Hong Kong people told me that in 2003, SARS arrived in Hong Kong. And the Hong Kong economy was completely, you know, going under. At that time, Hong Kong asked mainland China, can you lift the restrictions so that you can help us with our economy? They actually took the initiative so that there could be more economic integration between the two countries. Many of you have been to Hong Kong. Most people from most countries will never need a visa to go to Hong Kong. Guess who needs a visa? Chinese, mainland Chinese need to go get a visa. And just in the spirit of a broader audience, the cultural aspects, they put up two beautiful museums. And geez, the artists, politically opposite the Chinese government, are all hanging there. I was very, very surprised. So I think the complexity of the issue is not something I have the expertise or the time to talk about, but anyways, they are kind of really linked together, and I still believe the Hong Kong people have some hope that they'll be able to kind of reinvigorate their economy and their livelihoods.
You're listening to KUJin on the Chinese economic system. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977, or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
China also had a vision, or you know, can say the leadership had a vision in China of building infrastructure around the world. And as we mentioned, emerging markets need infrastructure. There's a $1 trillion infrastructure gap every year in the world, and you know, I just came from the World Bank. They were talking about we need infrastructure investment. So China came up with this Belt and Road Initiative. China wanted to put in money. They wanted to send construction workers. They wanted to do these development projects. That was a good idea in design. It was probably not well implemented, huge amount of problems, emerging market debt. But there's also a lot of misunderstanding, and that is also changing. By the way, just one statistic, 90% of the developing countries